My name is Jerry Kramer. Actually, it's Joseph Kramer, but I've been known by Jerry since I was a small kid. And I first came out to the Marshall Islands. I was working for Douglas Aircraft in Santa Monica, California. And I came out to, I had a specialty, and that was the inertial guidance system for the Nike Zeus missile. And I had just had my 20th birthday and was sent to Kwajalein, where they were blasting and testing the Nike Zeus missile to because of my specialty of the guidance system. I arrived on Kwajalein October 11th, 1961. Put in at Kwajalein, they had an extension course to University of Hawaii, and I signed up. I had attended several other colleges, never got a degree, thought I could get enough hours to work towards a degree, so I attended the University of Hawaii, and at this university extension was James and Alex Milne. And it was fascinating. I had come from the East Coast, Boston. I had, one of the reasons I wound up in Quad is I decided to see a little bit of the country and drove to California. And I had never been that far west of the East Coast. And then I just kept going, got to Hawaii, got to the Marshall Islands, and to see the rest, a little bit of the rest of the world and understand the different cultures was a real experience. To meet people from the islands and again to learn of different cultures and customs was just phenomenal. Anyway, in the course of meeting these people, I got to be friends, went to Ebi, visited family, and eventually we decided to go into business together. In those days, Kwajalein, to be in the Marshall Islands required 14th Naval District approval and Redstone Arsenal approval. You had Navy and the Army who had control of the mostly of the Marshall Islands because of its strategic nature and the testing that had been was being done and had been done. Remember the atomic bombs were tested in the Marshall Islands, and now the anti-missile defense system was being tested, and some, you know, we claim Johnson Island to be part of the Marshalls, and that's where the intercontinental ballistics missiles were tested. So the Marshalls was very strategic for the U.S., and they protected access. In addition to the difficulty in getting approval from both the Army and the Navy, when I first came out, except for the charter flights that came from Hawaii to Kwajalein for the military, to come into the Marshall Islands meant going to Guam and taking a Pan Am chartered seaplane, an SA-16, I think it was an SA-16, Grumman, once every 2 weeks, and you flew from Guam to Chuuk, and then you landed in the water in Ponape and stayed overnight, and then the next day on to Kwajalein, and then from Kwajalein on to Majuro, and the turnaround was once every 2 weeks, and Trust Territory government employees had a priority. Those were interesting days. If you took that aircraft, and that was basically the only way to get in, you had to check in 24 hours in advance, and if a Trust Territory government employee needed a seat, then you could be bounced up into the last minute of boarding. In any event, I had made we'd formed this business, and it was an extension of the business that James and Alex were both in, and the idea was I would to go to Fiji and buy a ship to go into the copra trade. Well, when I left Kwajalein, I put in the necessary applications to come back to live in the Marshall Islands, and went back to California. Is this going to be too long? Should I continue?
No, no, okay. In fact, right now, just to clarify a little bit about, so with the Milne brothers, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
You formed a company, and what was the purpose of the company?
Well, they were in island trading. They had had schooners and the old Likiap-built a couple of the old Lukiap built schooners, and then one I think that James bought in Kitabas, I'm trying to remember the name. Timatapula was one. Can't remember the names of the other vessels, but these were sailing vessels. And then the Trust Territory government had the Roke and the Runanim. These were larger vessels for picking up copra. And the only, basically, the business available in those days, and with the limited population and the limited disposable income that people had, and the limited sources of revenue, which were basically copra was the business. This is the old island business of the dried meat of the coconut purchased, and then the money that was received by people in the Outer Islands was used to buy trade goods off of the ship. There was a certain amount of bartering and trading, and as good as the Trust Territory government operations were, of course it was a government operation, and that left a bit to be desired, and there was room for private operation. It may be interesting to note, because this goes way back now, we're talking the early 60s, that at that time the trading companies were basically Kwajalein Import and Trading Company, Kitco, and Marshall Islands Import and Export Company, Mieko, and both of these were originated by the Navy after the war and had been turned over to civilian operation. They were major stockholder companies. Most Marshallese owned them, owned stock in the company. But there was a move towards more private entrepreneurship, and several small companies started to develop. Milne Brothers was one of them. The agreement, James had found a ship in Fiji, and I put in my application to return to the Marshalls, went back to California, working for Douglas Aircraft when I completed my contract on Quaj. That would have been in 1962, and finally both approvals came through, both from the Army and the Navy, and I proceeded to Fiji to purchase the ship. The ship was the Isakula. That's a Fijian name, and it was it's a shark god, and a traditional or ancient cultural story about the god of sharks, and that was the name of the vessel, the Isakula. It was had been built in Hull, England for the rubber trade in Singapore, and I dealt with W.R. Carpenters, who owned the vessel, and I put a deposit down and started the process of purchasing it, and found out that my partners didn't have the financial resources to put the money up to continue the purchase. It's another long story. I don't know if you want that whole story. It's a long one. I could be here.
Only if it illuminates things about, culturally.
Yeah. Well, I'll make a long story short. I wound up purchasing the vessel with my own resources and sailing it back to the Marshall Islands with a cargo that I arranged in Fiji. It's really, that particular story is a little bit anecdotal. I think I will mention it.
Okay.
When I determined that my partners didn't have the financial resources to meet their part of the obligation of putting up any funds, and W.R. Carpenters was trying to return the deposit, I developed a plan, and that was to have my partners place orders with companies that I had learned existed in Fiji. And several of the companies ultimately agreed to supply goods on credit. They didn't know that I was connected to this. It was like it was a different group of people that were ordering for the Marshalls. But I went ahead and appointed a ship's agent, and I told the ship's agent that the freight had to be prepaid in cash. So the suppliers were supplying the goods on credit to our company, but to the people who were placing the orders for the Marshalls, and I was getting cash up front for the freight for the ship agent, and we also took on cargo to be delivered to Nauru, Tuvalu, and the Kitabas, and that finally gave me enough cash to buy fuel, hire a crew, get provisions, and I did that. W.R. Carpenters finally released the vessel for the value of the deposit only, and didn't insist on the full payment. So loaded up, and so I had my 21st birthday in Fiji while this was going on.
But you knew nothing about boats.
Nothing about whatsoever.
Did you accompany that?
I went with the ship. I traveled with the ship.
And what kind of ship was this again?
It was a, the construction was a cast iron plates riveted and welded. It was, it was an older vessel. I can't remember offhand when it was built, but it was in the 20s or 30s. And it was a steamship, the boiler, and it used bunker C, a heavy fuel. And I had limited knowledge about what to do, but I was a fast learner. I hired the crew. We hired a captain out of the island of Rotuma and other crew members, some of whom actually wound up settling in the Marshalls and having families. Some people will know the names. And sailed it back to the Marshall Islands, stopping first in Tuvalu to discharge cargo, and then to Nauru, and then on to Kitibas, and then finally to Majuro. Well, this was a very large ship, and I had a limited understanding of the copra business. And we made the first run through the Marshall Islands and picked up all the copra. When I say all the copra, this was our problem, because when we get discharged and went on a second voyage, there just wasn't enough copra to even begin to fill the ship. It was very obvious that the ship was too big for the trade. And eventually, the business failed. Eventually, the business failed. That's another long story, but at some point I decided to leave the Marshall Islands.
Let me pause here. Were other people picking up copra? Was this the only run to pick up the copra?
We did the majority of the copra work. The government vessels were primarily devoted to the administrative work, but they did pick up copra. But we used, I think, better business tactics. We were gave better service to the people in the outer islands and watched prices very carefully to be very competitive. And for the little bit we did, and incidentally, we renamed the vessel. It was named the Nayrette, and that was named after Milne's mother, who had died from the Gilberts, Kitibas, and she ultimately died in the Marshall Islands. There was service. There's no doubt that the service didn't meet the needs, but also that we were overkill. We did too much and couldn't keep up with it financially.
Just maintaining the boat.
Just maintaining the vessel. The business failed. It's another long story. It actually had severe mechanical problems in one of the outer islands, Jolowit, and was stuck there. And I went back to Jolowit and had to do some physical work on the vessel to get it released. Finally came back to Majuro. Incidentally, it's before Egypt, there's a small island, and you can barely see the bow of the vessel where it's in its final resting place, sticking up. And it'll be there forever because the plates were cast iron, and they don't rust. They're going to be there for a long time.
Did you sink it there, or did it sink itself?
I'm going to go into some more stories. Okay. Anyway, the business failed financially. It was quite obvious that we were that the vessel was too big after we had an opportunity to start using it, and the cost of operation was expensive. It wasn't working. I decided to leave, and my partners attempted to run it. They had trouble meeting expenses, couldn't meet payroll, and the crew got sloppy, and we feel they actually sabotaged the vessel. They let the boiler run out of water, and the boiler blew in Jolowit. I was on Kwajalein trying to find a way of getting out, and they came to me and said if I could help get the vessel back to Majuro, that they would assist me in leaving the Marshalls. This would be back about 63 or 64.
Now, why was it difficult getting out?
I didn't have the money. I was broke.
Okay.
And I stayed with friends on Kwajalein, which you're not supposed to do, and got caught. It was still a military vessel, but no, I had to go back to Majuro. They weren't going to buy me a ticket out. But I went to, and when the vessel blew, a lot of the crew disappeared. There were a few diehards that were still there. I think the crew was six left out of a crew that I think must have been about 18. And when I got there, I determined that the boiler tube was cracked, and the firebox had distorted from the heat because it's supposed to be surrounded by water, and they ran out of water. I'd gotten a couple of books, and there were ways to do the repair. The firebox could be repaired by making large rubber gaskets and unscrewing these big 2 or 3 inch bolts and making patches. And the boiler tube could be repaired by drilling through this 3/4 inch cast iron tube by hand, and then threading it and putting in a bolt, cutting the bolt and clinching the bolt. It was about a six, and the tube was about 2 feet in diameter. And I did this myself. It took me about 4 months by hand, crawling in, drilling by hand, threading, cutting the bolt.
Now, how did you survive during these 4 months?
There was, people were very, in the Outer Islands, even till today for the most part, people are extremely cordial, very friendly. Jello was no different. Very cordial people. And there was, Jello had been a major installation of the Japanese, and there was a lot of leftover equipment and some U.S. equipment. There was remains of a Jeep and a small power plant and a few other things. And salvaging some of these pieces, I was able to take the steam generator and make it into a diesel generator and run it off of some of the fuel. So we had a little bit of electricity, which we used to operate a pump. And anyway, of course, in those days, the field trip ship only came but once every 3 or 4 months if you were lucky. And there was only one trip, and I can remember being thrilled when the ship came in and we were able to get some canned tuna and some toilet paper and some soap. Other than that, I remember the ship had sardines and tomato sauce in the hold as part of their trade goods. That was it. That was the only food, except for the shoreside food. And people helped us with food on shore.
Shoreside food meaning what?
Local Marshallese food. There was a lot of it.
And the field trip ship is?
Was the government, the Trust Territory government, Rokin, running him.
Okay. And the purpose of the field trip?
Was to buy the copra and do the trading and supply, do some of the administrative work. There were clinics, dispensaries. There was an administrative representative. But there was basically, in those days, there was no money in the Outer Islands. You could count the number of dollars on your fingers. People lived a true subsistence life. It was trading copra for trade goods. Communications was limited, although there was a radio system. And there were the Likiap schooners, but I don't believe one came to Jellawit the whole time I was there.
Can you explain the Likiap schooners?
These were vessels that I think were originally built by the Broom and Capelli boat shop in Likiap. And they were actually the backbone of the copra industry during the Japanese administration, because basically the vessels would go to an outer island and come back to the district center. That's the Roke and the Runanim supplemented this service, but the direct runs of the old Likiap schooners that were built in Likiap. Likiap had been actually quite famous 100 years ago for vessels. Wooden vessels coming from Australia to the U.S. and back through the Marshall Islands back to Australia. They'd stop in Likiap to have the seams caulked, and basically dry dock work. The way it was done is those sandy bottom shallows, and the ship would the wooden schooners would come in, and they'd ballast them and tip them sideways and do one side caulking the seams, painting, and then ballast them and tip them the other way and caulk the seams. And anyway, they also built vessels there. And there was also some wooden military vessels from World War II that were rebuilt into schooners. I think some of it was done here by Robert Ramis, and some of it was done in Likiap. And there were several of those. Let me see if I can remember any names.
And when did that?
Well, they slowly but surely phased out. Basically, they couldn't compete with the Trust Territory government on freight and frequency, and especially on carrying passengers. And eventually, these were phased out. I think it was mainly for financial reasons. There are still a few people that are still alive that were involved in the old building of the Likiap schooners. Some of the old Capellis, I think, are still and still trained and remember the days. But it'd be nice to get more of the story of so many of those people are gone. Robert Ramis had some fabulous stories. A few of the older Capelli people are still available that might be able to tell some of the stories of the boat building in Likiap and also the boat pool here in Majuro. It's not universally known, but the military did some of the wood boat maintenance, which Robert Ramis took over, and it was called the boat pool. So what's there now? It's the there's a Protestant mission, a Didic, Samuel. Behind it, is now mostly submerged, is a long concrete ramp that was used to pull the vessels up that Robert Ramis used for several years. That still exists. I think you can see it from an aircraft, but it's the shoreside part of the facility has been covered and buildings built on it, but the area that goes down into the lagoon is still there, and it's in very good shape, actually. It's quite surprising. But anyway, back to where was I? Where we got the boat repaired, and there was quite a bit of the old Japanese military facilities rusted out and broken and what have you, still available in Jellicoe. I'm not sure exactly. I haven't been there for several years, but there was quite a bit there. One of the things that was there was a still, and there was a Marshallese guy that made alcohol for drinking. And when we realized the ship was repairable, and we were going to be able to sail it back to the Marshalls, we realized also that it was it didn't have sufficient fuel and it didn't have sufficient water. And to get the water, we cleaned out the lifeboat and rowed it ashore. And then there were seven of us and we had buckets. And we went inland to the Catholic mission where there was an old German cistern. And I understand that cistern was built during the German administration, which would take it back 150 years. Out of a locally made cement, and they made the cement out by burning wood and coral, and they came up with a type of lime, and it made a cement, and the original cistern was actually made out of this material. We had one guy would climb up to the top of the cistern and bucket into a sump, and then we'd pick up two buckets each and then walk ashore to the shoreline about a mile away and bucket it into the boat, and then row the boat out to the ship and bucket it, haul it up and pour it into the tanks, and we loaded 20,000 gallons of water. Well, altogether this enterprise took 6 months. And we went around and gathered firewood because we could burn firewood. We could open up you could open up the burner, and where the preheated bunker sea fuel was injected, and we could load firewood into the boiler. So we gathered firewood, and the whole enterprise took about 6 months. One day. We had in planning on making the move and not deciding exactly when the date would be. We had a party, and the gentleman that made the alcohol generously donated quite a bit of it, and I had a bit of it, and got a little bit high, and when we rode the lifeboat back to the ship that night, my hand got caught between the lifeboat and the ship. I got it badly abraded, and I got an infection, and the local health aide doused it with iodine and what have you, and it got worse. And the crew sort of decided it was now or never, although it was going to be a problem. And one day we set sail for Majuro. After setting sail, we found a few stowaways on board. There was a kid, a couple of women. Anyway, we made it back to Majuro, and it turns out I had a real problem. I was got into a high fever, and my hand swelled up to about twice the size. And as it turns out, I was allergic to iodine. But we got the vessel here, and we burnt all of the firewood. We burnt the oil was left. We burnt the firewood. We had to break up the furniture. We burnt the furniture, and we had some copra bags left over. We burnt all the copra bags, but we made it in a Majuro. But it was the business model wasn't going to work, and my partners decided that they couldn't afford to even try another trip, and it was tied up to the dock. It was tied up to the dock for many months, and it finally sunk at the dock on a storm, and the Trust Territory government decided that it had to be moved because it was taking up valuable dock space, and they floated it again and left it, and it broke loose from the dock, went across the lagoon, and sunk in its final resting place. And that's the end of the Nayaret.
So after that?
I decided not to leave. I decided not to leave for a few reasons. I decided not to leave, number one, I think, because I was disappointed with myself in not being able to do better with the opportunities that were available. And I felt like maybe I was leaving with my tail between my legs and saying I had failed. And I didn't like the feeling of failure. And number two, I had made some very good, very close friends here. And I wanted to try to do better. I did Dr. John Iman and Isaac Lanwe and Dwight Heine and people that I felt very close to that encouraged me to try to stay on and do something. And number three, my partners and I blamed each other for what happened, and they were making it difficult for me to stay, and that's what I needed for the impetus to decide to stay.
Resistance only made you stronger.
The resistance made me stronger.
Okay. Yeah. And could you talk a little bit about these friendships? As an outsider, did you feel it difficult to relate to life?
Well, initially, of course, I mean, everything was very different. It was very difficult. But eventually you realize that people use their surroundings and their environment to develop a life. And I've done a lot of travel, and more I feel that human beings are pretty much the same. They take the opportunities that are available and they work it into a lifestyle to make the best they can for where and how they're living. It was only a matter of time before I felt I became part of what was happening, because I had to live in the same limited infrastructure, assets, and what have you. You didn't have running water. You did what you had to do. Superficially, when someone comes in and sees the lifestyles people may lead, they don't realize that lifestyle has been developed because of the conditions that are prevail, and you do the best you can to make the life the best you can. I was very fortunate to meet some of the people I did meet and to call them friends. I consider that Dwight Heine was probably one of the most intelligent people I've ever met in my life. He was a true intellect. He was not only was he educated, but he had a latent intelligence. And had he been in another environment, would have done more. But he did a tremendous amount in not only the Marshall Islands but in Micronesia. Isaac Lanwe, a natural satirist, a very intelligent person. Dr. John Iman, dedicated in his position as the chief of staff of the local hospital, did things that a book needs to be written, and some of these people need to be honored for the tremendous benefits that they did for the Marshall Islands. Right after the war, the military realized that they were going to have to get local people more involved in the day-to-day necessities of medical and food and business and administration. And there were special schools, special training. I know that Isaac Lanwee went to a special, and Dr. John Iman went to special medical, and excuse me, another one I got to remember is Henry Samuel. They went to special intensive medical military training. Isaac Lanwee was an eye doctor, and when I first came, they flew him around Micronesia. He did all of the cataract surgery. Dr. John, chief of staff, I remember some tremendous things. I also remember that the man never slept. I wound up, his wife was related to the people I had been in business with, and when I first came back, I stayed with them, and I wound up living with them for several years, for a few years at least. And I remember living with Dr. John, and he never got a night's sleep. He was on call 24 hours a day. And because of culture and custom, a lot of times a doctor or another person is not supposed to see a relative nude, not supposed to touch them. And so Dr. John, not being related, he was able to see any patient, and as a result, 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, and then bang, 6, 7 o'clock in the morning, and he was the chief surgeon. He did some remarkable work. I can remember a local patient that had a head trauma, wound up with a hematoma, and Dr. John, in this little hospital in Madro, actually drilled into his skull to relieve the hematoma. We had another name just popped up, you gotta excuse me, Trega Rijoda. The hospital's named after his brother, Amir Rijoda, and Trega was another doctor. These guys did remarkable work with the limited training that they had under the U.S. military. There was a move when I first came out to keep the place isolated because of the military testing. Not only did you have to go through this business of for a foreigner to come, there was no tourism, zero, zilch. It was just too difficult. But not only did you have to go through both Army and Navy approval to get into the Marshall Islands, but the Trust Territory government limited scholarships to 2 years. No one was able to get a scholarship for a full degree. And you could get an associate's degree, and even that was difficult. But a few of our brave people, Amita Kabua and Dwight Heine, and the names pop off my head quickly, worked their way through and were able to get their degrees. And it was with no small part of difficulty. Like I said, they could get a 2-year scholarship, limited funds for an associate's degree, but to get a 4-year degree required extraordinary efforts on their own part.
Why do you think the Trust government did that?
They wanted to limit you have the U.S. government making strategic use of the land here, the Kwajalein military base testing, what had happened in Aniwetok and Bikini. I mean, there was United Nations, the mandate by the United Nations was that the U.S. would develop the infrastructure of the Marshall Islands leading towards self-government. My feeling is that there had been a lot of abuse in the destruction of the land and the nuclear radiation, residual radiation that was left in Bikini and Aniwetok, the testing that had irradiated other parts of the Marshall Islands, the ongoing testing that was done on Kwajalein, and the very limited benefits in those days that the people were receiving. Picked up in the mid-corridor and moved to Ebi and promised that they would be taken care of. Then, not having access to electricity or running water, when they were living in an outer island environment, that was reasonable. You had a few people living over a very large piece of land, and you could make do on a subsistence. But when they were congregated on Ebi, it required more modern social development. You had to have housing, and you no longer could put up the type of limited structures that people would live in the outer islands. You had to have more sophisticated housing. You had to have running water, electricity, and sewage, and what have you. And life was very difficult on Ebi. And the funds that were coming from the use of kwajalein at that time went, for the most part, to the Trust Territory government and was given to the Congress of Micronesia to distribute. Congress of Micronesia, in other words, people from Yap, Palau, Chuuk, Ponape, and Kushrai had a vote on how to spend the rental money from kwajalein. This led finally to a small group of people in the Marshall Islands deciding that independence was the only option. We had to get out from under, first of all, not being able to make a decision about how the land of the Marshall Islands was being used by outside forces. That's another story. I attended the meetings on the... Oh boy. I never told this story to anybody.
Who were these people?
Wow. I got to think about this one a little bit, but I don't blame the U.S. government, certainly not the people of the United States, because the people of the United States would not have allowed what the U.S. military did in Micronesia and in the Marshall Islands. The lack of proper compensation and the lack of providing for educational, medical, and social welfare for the people that they were displacing from the land, limiting their ability to run a business, not allowing tourists to come in. The U.S. military did this. Was it done intentionally? Well, it had to be done intentionally. They were limiting access because of the strategic importance of the Marshall Islands. And I think there must have been a conscientious plan that this had to be limited, because or else intelligent, educated Marshallese were not going to allow this to happen. If there was a restriction on people coming in, on the use of their land, then they would have expected compensation. They would have looked towards improving the lifestyle of the average Marshallese. So it made sense for the military to limit what could happen here. Well, slowly but surely, I mean, it had to happen. We wound up with Marshallese that were able to get the education and had sufficient financial resources to be able to independently be able to approach the U.S. I mean, when you're looking for food and you're looking for clothes and you're looking for a place to stay, you can't very well argue with Washington. You can't buy a ticket to go back there. And that's what was happening. Well, slowly but surely, there was some development. And we had some terrific leaders. Like I said, I mean, Amita Kabur and Dwight Heine and some others. And Isaac Landwehr was also a major politician. And I'm sure I'm leaving out a whole bunch of names, but I'm being hit cold here, and I got to think about these stories. These were extremely intelligent people. They lacked maybe the environmental worldliness, but some of that they were able to pick up in the education that they pursued on their own. And actually, Dwight Heine wound up being promoted to the point of assistant. What was the guy in Saipan was the high commissioner, assistant high commissioner, because he knew too much. And he was too intelligent, and they had to try to put him in positions where they could have some influence over him. Dwight and Amit actually grew up together. That's another long story. Dwight was kind of adopted by Amit's parents. But anyway, suddenly, I can only remember the way there was some general discussion, but I was one day invited to a meeting. And the meeting was, if I remember correctly, it was chaired by Keith Smith. Keith Smith was the general manager of Miekel under when the military first started the business, the Marshall Islands Import-Export Company. It was kind of interesting. I guess he was retired Navy. And he was in the Navy, retired Navy, and that's another story. But he started MEACO like the Navy. He had the officers were in uniform, and he tried to impose the military discipline. He left, came back. There's a long history of Keith Smith, and I can't begin to tell you the whole story. But he later came back. He was a manager for Kitco for a while. But he was at the head of the table, and I can remember suddenly, they very slowly, the discussion started coming in. It was almost like people felt that this was a, how can I say, anti-government or suddenly to talk about our future as independence. And slowly, as this word came, I'm trying to remember, Bartimius Lundgren was there, Amata Kabua, Isaac Lanwee, Henry Samuel, I think Dwight Heine, but I'm talking now about almost 40 years ago.
So what was the date?
Oh boy, I'm gonna...
68?
I may have some notes, but I just kind of, it was during the Congress of Micronesia, before this was what led to independence. But as there seemed to be an undercurrent that these people had this on their mind and were always afraid to say the word, independence. The Marshalls had been independent. Under the Germans, apparently at one point, recognized the independence of the Marshall Islands. There was a flag and there was a stamp going back 150 some years ago. And then the independence was lost as the, not through war or anything, but the world cut up the Pacific, and the Spanish said, we own them, and sold them to the Germans, and there was a movement. Marshallese always felt that they were independent, and felt that they were occupied. That was the impression that I had from the stories that I heard, especially from Amata. But anyway, at this first meeting, I can remember that the sudden upswell, when people started to finally open up with what they were thinking, and the word was, our only future is an independent Marshall Islands. We are a unique people, this is our country, and we're tired of being taken advantage of, and yes, our brethren in Micronesia, but this is our money that they're playing with, and we want out. The U.S. is talking about a permanent political status. Marshalls has got no business being permanently tied to Saipan or to Palau. We're our own people. And that meeting was the beginning of the independence movement of the Marshall Islands. The U.S. didn't really fight it. They kind of let it develop, but I don't believe that their initial reception took the Marshallese seriously. It was like they're talking, but suddenly, not suddenly, because of the background meetings that were being held, Amata Kabua, I think it was during the term when he was the president of the Congress of Micronesia, made the announcement. I'm trying to remember, Charlie Dominic was involved. I'm not sure if he was at that initial meeting, but he was in the Congress. And I can't remember exactly. I need to actually confer with him because he and I probably have the best memory of exactly how this thing all came about. We were young kids at the time. Let me see, I was still in my 20s, and so wasn't Charlie. And we need to, but this really should be written down also in the history of the Marshall Islands that hasn't been written. But that was the beginning of the movement of independence of the Marshall Islands.
So what were you doing at this time, and why were you invited, do you think?
I was working for Amata Kabua. He was the president of, chief executive officer for Marshall Islands Import-Export Company. And it was kind of a weird operation in that I worked for him and not necessarily for MEACO, and he gave me tasks to perform. We became very good friends. And I can't say much more about it except that during the course of working with MEACO, I got introduced to a guy named Shigeru Wasi. And Shigeru was... mechanically had a tremendous intuition. His English was pretty good. His Japanese was excellent, and he was Marshallese. I think it was his grandfather that was Japanese. He did all of the mechanical work. He did some amazing work. It's typical of someone very proficient mechanically out in the bush. He did the electrical, the electronics. One particular remarkable job that he did, I'll point out this was after we, well, first let me just tell you what led to this. Miyako had a vessel called the Miyako Queen. They had it built and rebuilt a couple of times, and then determined that it was small for the trade, and then they went and bought a used vessel and renamed it the Rolik Ratik. Rolik, sunrise, sunset, chains of islands of the Marshall Islands. They decided to surplus the Miyako Queen. Amata offered it to us. By this time, Shigeru Wasi and myself had gone into a business. We were repairing old jukeboxes and some electrical equipment, and we were doing a little bit of business, and we were starting to do a little bit of import. And I spoke to Amata one day, and he said, "Look, why don't you buy the Miyako Queen? And you guys, because Rolik Ratik is not sufficient to do the trade. The government ships are not doing the job, and we need the extra service for the people in the outer islands. So how about buy the Miyako Queen?" Well, I was elated. And by this time, we'd brought in another partner, and that was Charlie Dominic. So it was the three of us, myself, Shigeru Wasi, Charlie Dominic. And we formed the company for the lack of a better name. No one could decide on a name, so I named it. I called it Acme Importers, ACME, Acme Importers. And I wanted the ship. But Shigeru especially said, "Hey, this is foolhardy. We don't have 10 cents between us. We buy the ship, we can't buy the fuel, we can't get the trade goods. Unless we've got some money, my vote is that we don't take it." Well, we did buy the ship, and I want to tell you a little story after that, but the purchase of the ship is another tremendous story. but I was talking about Shigeru Wasi, and I want to tell you this little story. The main shaft of the main engine failed, and this is the crankshaft. Anybody that knows engines is going to say, and this was a big engine. The crankshaft in this thing had a crankshaft journal that must have been about 4 or 5 inches in diameter. It was, you know, 1,000 horsepower engine or something. And this happened in one of the outer islands of the Marshalls. And this particular journal, the bearing failed, and it scored this journal, and the engine couldn't be run the way it was. Shigeru went out and he disassembled the engine so that cylinder didn't have to fire. And then brought it into Majuro. But the engine didn't run well without this one cylinder. We needed to take it to Japan for dry dock. So he built an apparatus with fine sandpaper and strapped it on the journal, and by hand, he machined this journal down, and then built a bearing by hand by using this special metal, bearing metal, and then scraping it by hand. And over a period of about a month, he was able to repair this engine so that it did go all the way to Japan under its own power. But he had an amazing mechanical intuition. Our company eventually, that was actually the forerunner of Pacific International. Was Acme Importers, but at the beginning of the Pacific International, we all decided to go our own ways, and our company split up. But going back to the purchase of the Miyako Queen, do you want to hear that story? We had a guy working for us, Battery Jurlong, and supposedly his family had come into possession of, there was a lot of stories. Some of the stories said that part of the money and the assets that they had in an outer island of the Marshall Islands were part of the booty left over by a a pirate named Bully Hayes, and that part of it came from a Chinese worker who was actually, I guess, under the Japanese. Okinawans and some Chinese were held as almost a slave labor, and he had somehow gathered some German and Japanese gold. And when he tried to leave the Marshall Islands, the authorities at the time stopped him, and he went to an outer island. Nobody ever heard from him again. Well, supposedly, some of this treasure and cash and what have you had found its way into the Gerlong family in Ebon. And I went to Ebon, and these Joe Gerlong, Battery's brother, was kind of in charge of this bit of treasure. To make a long story short, because this story will go on forever, I borrowed personally from Joe Gerlong. He lived in a thatched house, metal siding, old island ways, no running water, no generator, no flush toilet, all this sort of thing. And I borrowed, this would be about in the mid-60s, I think it would be about 1966, I borrowed $10,000 from him.
Oh, so this is pirate money.
We don't know exactly where it all came from. It'd be an interesting thing. I don't know who in the family anymore knows, because Joe is gone, Battery's gone. I don't know how much of the family is still alive. I heard that someone else got a big chunk of money. We wound up paying back the money we borrowed. The deal we made basically was they would be our exclusive agent in Ebon, and we would pay them interest. I think it was 10% interest, and we would pay them monthly to repay the $10,000 that I borrowed. And we did. We paid it all back. We made them the exclusive agent. We did everything that we were supposed to do. But I heard that someone else got a chunk of it. And is anything still there today? I don't know. But I saw a lot of money. And some of the money was in old bills, which were silver certificates, which I sent into San Francisco to a friend, and he exchanged that for bars of silver. And some of those are still here in the Marshall Islands. Actually, Charlie Dominic got them. He wanted to see them one day, and he took them, and I never saw them again. But and there was some bullion, some silver bullion. But anyway, came back with that money, and then my partners agreed, okay, let's go for it. And we got the Miracle Queen on terms, but we used the $10,000 for buying trade goods and fuel, and we went into the business, and that we started Outer Island shipping and copra purchasing.
Okay, so back to Independence, the first meeting. So by that time, we're talking about 1968.
It's earlier than that. Wait a minute. No. That could have been later. I'm sorry. It could have been, it could have been 68, 70. It could have been around that period, because I'd still, even though that was the end of my relationship with Miyako, I still had a very close relationship with Amata Kabua and that crowd. The crowd was limited. We spent a lot of time at the Coconut Rendezvous Club, and there were periodic meetings. Go ahead. Did you have a question about that?
Periodic meetings that centered on Independence?
Oh, it's centered on Independence.
Okay. So again, when you were called to that first meeting, you were working with?
Far Amata. When I say working Far Amata, I attended several Congress of Micronesia meetings as Amata's guest. And basically, I did some running around for him. And but that was very early in the Congress days. I became less involved as time went on. And at the final stages of the Independence discussions and negotiations, I was totally out of it. I was there for the initial meetings and some of the planning and discussions about whether or not it should go forward. But when it came down to the actual negotiations and the plan, I was out of it. It was pretty well restricted to the Marshallese leadership.
And so, at what point did the business you just talked about eventually became PII?
Eventually, you are. Yeah, correct.
And
we slowly closed down Acme Importers.
Okay, so yeah. Why don't you talk about that, the transition and the people you were meeting at that time?
Okay. Charlie became more involved in the government.
Charlie
Dominick. He was in the Congress. He became a senator. He was the minister. Was he the minister of foreign affairs? And he had less interest in the business. And it's because of this loose jointing with other issues, it's a little bit difficult to give a chronology of the chain of events. But there was a committee formed under the Marshall Islands government, and that was the Marshall Islands Development Authority. I sat on that committee. Now, Charlie had an executive position. Was he the chair? God, we got to talk to him. I'm not sure exactly how this went. But anyway, one of the assignment that I got was, what happened first was the, from early days, Amata had put me on the COPRA stabilization board. This was the Marshall Islands representatives that went to Saipan to sit on the board to decide on what was happening with COPRA. With the stabilization fund and the sales and what have you, another long story. The delegate that I mostly traveled with was Andrew Isaiah. He was the Marshall Islands delegate. He and I used to go on a regular basis to Saipan to meet on this COPRA stabilization board. I had proposed that the Marshalls should, we had problems marketing, and we was very much under control of a company in Guam, Atkins Kroll. They dictated the terms, they made the sales. COPRA could only be sold through them. Sometimes COPRA was in storage for months and months, so it was a financial hardship. Sometimes the COPRA would spoil, and we weren't getting any added value, and we're looking for what we can do. And my pet project was trying to go into the COPRA processing. When the Marshall Islands Development Authority was formed, this became my project, and that was to try to do something about COPRA processing. Charlie Dominick had been in the Philippines and had met an American, Frank Jerome, who had a major position on COPRA processing in the Philippines. That was one input that I had. Charlie had made friends with him and stayed in contact with him. And in the Philippines, actually, Frank Jerome had started a company called Legazpi Oil Company. They were the first COPRA processors. Up to that point, COPRA had been exported to Europe. Actually, Frank Jerome had developed continuous processing machinery, which was meant for animal fats. So it was meant for rendering for cows and what have you, and then got adapted to use for vegetable seeds and oil-bearing seeds in the vegetable industry and into COPRA. This guy was still alive, and he had been one of the actual inventors and developers of the machinery that did the extraction of coconut oil and animal oils, animal fats, and what have you, and other oilseed product oils. He was operating in the Philippines. He had started this company called the Legazpi Oil Company. He sold it to I believe the name of the company was Ayala, a very famous large Philippine group. And eventually the government of the Philippines nationalized it. Although there are a lot of private operators, it comes under the umbrella of this company that Frank Jerome started. And Charlie Dominick had met him and formed a friendship. So he was one of the first, his company in the States, Baker Commodities, one of the first people I approached when I was given the mandate to try to do something about COPRA. First, we had to get some seed money. And we went to the Congress of Micronesia, and they referred to the Trust Territory Government. The Trust Territory Government wasn't very sympathetic with it. What we needed was a plan, both an implementation plan. And we were at that time dealing with a company called Holmes and Naver. They were doing the cleanup work at Bikini Atoll, and they were a major U.S. engineering company. And I had spoken to them about helping us to develop the plan for the COPA processing because they did major international processing, coal, uranium, all this sort of thing. So I went back to California and I spent about 3 months writing a proposal and coming up with a book on why we should do the COPA processing business in the Marshall Islands. We published the book. I still have a copy of it. What year was that? That was in the, I'm sure it was in the early 70s. And we presented this book to the Trust Territory Government, and we convinced the Congress of Micronesia to put up $300,000 in seed money. With the seed money, I had further discussions with Frank Jerome. To make a long story short, he agreed to finance the construction under certain covenants and agreements wherein we operated it under contract. We had certain guarantees from the government, and we would pay ourselves on a regular basis, his group on a regular basis pay until the construction costs were liquidated, and at that point the RMI government would own the facility. And we had the management contract to that point. Mr. Jerome said, look, Jerry Kramer, if you believe that the Marshall Islands government will adhere to the covenant rules and regulations that we're putting into place and will allow us to operate and pay ourselves back for the construction costs, then to prove that, you come to work for me. So I went to work for Frank Jerome. And that was the only way that this project was going to go forward. We had $300,000 and it was a $2 million project. And he would put up the rest of the money and build the plant, provided, number one, that I went to work for him. So I came back and disclosed this to MITA. And by this time, Acme Importers was doing less and less business. And we formed a company called Pacific International Inc. The primary purpose was to build Tobelar. But that gave us some construction capacity. And I wanted Pacific International to continue. Charlie Dominic wanted out, and Shigeru Wasi eventually wanted out. So we looked at the fair market value of the stock at that time, of the value of what we owned together. And I paid off Charlie and Shigeru and they wanted out of Pacific International at that time. But Pacific International basically had me as a small piece, and Jerome and his people as the major owners. When we built Tobelar, I wanted this thing to continue, and they really didn't, and so they agreed to sell me their shares. And I eventually bought all of Frank Jerome's and it was Richard Jerome and Al Fuchs, other people who were involved. I eventually bought all of their stock. So eventually, I bought all of the stock of the company and eventually distributed this stock to my wife and children. So that this is a true family-owned corporation. In the meantime, we managed Tobelar, and where we had expected to pay the same, the average price for copra that was being paid throughout the Pacific, and from the added value, pay ourselves off in a 5-year period, we were able to pay ourselves off for the construction costs in 3 years, and pay amongst the highest price for copra in the Pacific. In other words, the plan for copra processing in the Marshall Islands and added value worked. We had control of our product, we added value, we provided more jobs, and we were making a profit that allowed us to pay more for copra than was being paid to producers anywhere in the Pacific. The government asked us to stay on, and there are several other stories involved, but since our start in 1976 and the opening of Tobelar in 1979, we have had renewed contracts and are still under contract to manage the company. We don't participate in the profits. We have a fixed annual fee for doing our management, and we do the management. We've continued it on. I can't say that it hasn't been tremendously lucrative for us, but I feel it's a community responsibility. I'm very proud and pleased that we're able to contribute so much to the economy of the Marshall Islands by being involved in managing basically the only indigenous operation that really brings in revenue and affects people so much in the Outer Islands.
A couple of questions for clarity. One is, why do you think the trust territory government didn't like the idea initially? And if you could just clarify, when you're talking about governments, which governments you're talking about? Because at this time, Marshall Islands had what kind of government?
Okay. This was still under the Congress, but we had a government locally. Was it Ndigila? What was the name of our? It wasn't just the council, but there was a local government. God, we got to get a hold of Charlie Dominic. I'm messing this one up, and I'd like to get it right. But we did have a local government that established this Marshall Islands Development Authority. We had a local Congress. We had a local Congress, and we had a local municipal government.
And that government,
and it was still had the Congress of Micronesia, correct. And we had the Trust Territory Government.
On top of everything.
That's right.
Okay, so the three levels of government.
Yeah, right. And the Trust Territory Government, under the mandate from the United Nations, was leading Micronesia towards their independence.
Okay, was that a part of their
That was charge? Mandate. They were charged with that.
Okay, so is that different from the way it was in the 60s?
Well, no, that was technically their responsibility. They just weren't doing it.
70s things
yeah.
were changing.
Yeah, because at this point we had astute Micronesians that were saying, hey, this is it. We're supposed to be leading towards self-government, let's go for it. By this time we had Micronesians who one way or another had been able to get the education and the personal financial ability to be able to present themselves appropriately. In the 60s, it couldn't happen. There wasn't, the funds weren't available, organization wasn't available, and the education level was limited. But in the 70s, it was coming along.
So back to the COPRA, which is critically important to the economy, why do you think the Trust Territory government was unresponsive to that, to having an indigenous production of COPRA?
I'm not completely sure, and I don't want to sound paranoid, but we understand at one point Atkins Kroll was an arm of an intelligence agency of the U.S. government in Guam.
Who's Atkins Kroll?
They were the contracted company that purchased 100% of the COPRA and handled it for the Trust Territory. No one could market or manufacture or do anything. It had to go through Atkins Kroll, and Atkins Kroll dictated how it was handled. I think that another thing was there wasn't a lot of respect or regard in Saipan for the abilities in Micronesia that were developing. That came slowly, and that came, I believe it was like a light bulb that was coming on slowly, and people were realizing that there were competence and capabilities inside Micronesia in the different districts. I think that investigation and determination was that we weren't really up to speed in being able to handle what we were asking for. That, you know, maybe our production was too small, that it didn't have a future. It may have been in some ways a preconceived notion that they were looking to validate. But they had studies done. They did have studies done. As a matter of fact, one of the guys who did the study, I think he's back in Saipan. I'm trying to remember his name. There's some players that, I'm terrible with names. If I had a little bit of time, I can check notes. But this one guy ran for Senate in Hawaii, I remember. But there was this business of this core group in Saipan felt that they knew what was best. And any new ideas would take with a grain of salt. However, the Congress of Micronesia was, you know, you're talking about a very intelligent group of people elected from their constituency who could realize that what we had proposed had merit. And they approved a budget of $300,000.
So PII gets off the ground in 76?
Yeah, mainly to build Tobelar.
And so in 79, Tobelar, the cocoa processing
opens up.
Opens up. And then, so talk about what happens after that in relation to PII and in relation to the people that you knew at the time and Independence.
Okay. First of all, let me tell you that you know, about the decision to go ahead with building Tobelar, the rest of Micronesia slowly but surely went out of the business. There's no more cocoa production anywhere else in Micronesia. And we are one of the more successful operations today all over the Pacific of the small islands. Now, we, you know, we can't compete with the Philippines that produces 98% of the world's export in cocoa, but Papua New Guinea, Fiji, Samoa, we wound up being the most sophisticated operators in the copra industry. I say that with a bit of pride. Now, okay, where were we again now? You want me to comment on?
After Tobelar opens up, we're moving toward independence and how things are changing.
Yeah. Well, you can imagine the boom in the economy when suddenly all of the tax revenue and fees from Kwajalein are going to the government of the Marshall Islands. So anyway, there was the fact that the Marshalls wanted independence, that Saipan wanted to be a Commonwealth. People in Saipan always felt that they were Americans, that they wanted to be a Commonwealth, that Palau wanted to be independent. There was a certain amount of interaction between Palau and the Marshalls in their desire for independence, and because he was like Amata was the father, Amata Kabu was the father of this nation. He had a lot of guts. He took a lot of chances. He was educated, intelligent, and he was a leader who was born with the authority. He was eventually going to grow into it, and because he was raised as a leader, he was able to handle it. I make a distinction there because we have a lot of leadership that suddenly comes to power, elected, is not used to the power and is not used to handling it. Amata was used to handling the authority. He grew up with it. He was able to present himself very well. There's a lot of other people that had major involvement. I mean, it wouldn't be right to not mention Tony DeBrum and some of the other people initially, but there's a lot of anecdotal stories that fit into this, and they're coming to mind as we're discussing. One of them is the input that Nauru had. Nauru, of course, Hamid Roberts was the father of his country. He demanded independence, declared independence, and became independent. And ultimately, that's what happened to the Marshalls. We declared that we were going to be independent. That was the end of it. We just went for it for that day and went for it. But the Nauru got involved. I remember Hamid Roberts talking about the inalienable rights of sovereignty that the Marshall Islands had, talking about that to some of our leadership, and I remember that he had a definite impression. There was a lawsuit about funds that he may have put up to assist the Marshall Islands. The lawsuit was the results of a report by a major newspaper and Cisco Uladong out of Palau that Nauru had in fact put up a few million bucks to help the Marshalls fight for their independence. It was reported in the newspaper, and I can't go into all the details in that now. I mean, I was even a witness in the case. But basically, Hamid Roberts and Nauru filed suit against Gannett News, and I heard that there was a multi-million dollar settlement for that. But there was definitely some influence from Nauru and the Marshalls going after its independence.
And what was wrong with that?
Not so much what was wrong with it, but the way it was reported. They felt that the reporting was underhanded. God, I gotta go back and check notes. I can't remember all of the stories, but in any event, it was becoming obvious with the Marianas wanting to be part of the be a Commonwealth of the United States or have an entity with the U.S. Palau wanting to be independent. The rest of Micronesia feeling some sort of kinship, and I'm not sure how that kinship goes. The failure of the Trust Territory government to really get a feeling of or an entity or a program where there was any sort of unity in Micronesia. There was never any, I mean, to travel to another district was an expense, or to travel to your headquarters, to Saipan, was an expense that the average Marshallese would never be able to afford. There was no attempt to get products going from one area to another. There was no attempt at commerce. So the Trust Territory government did very little to form any sort of, the only unity there was in the Congress. But we had our own customs, we had our own languages, and Palau had, again, they were fighting for their independence. I'm trying to remember the name of the guy at the time. Charlie will know all these names, I'm just very bad with it. God, but he was anyway. In any event, the U.S. government finally realized and agreed and started negotiating independence and negotiating the compacts. I remember anecdotal stories exactly the chronology of what happened when. People like Charlie and Tony are going to be better suited to give you that information. But we then became independent. Congress was dissolved. Of course, all during the Congress of Micronesia and the negotiations for the nuclear damage and what have you, the place started opening up. We got a little bit of tourism, a little bit more money came through in Quadge. They started being a little bit more recognizing Marshallese rights. I don't know if you ever heard of the story of the sit-ins on Quadge, where under Imata Kabua's leadership, they had one major Alep over there, Handel Dribble. They reoccupied some of the facilities that were being used by Kwajalein in the Mid Corridor and on Kwajalein itself. And my understanding is that in fact, the leases had expired, and Marshallese had every right to move back to their land. This was a turning point in the negotiations, both for the Marshall Islands government. I think there's probably a problem in the fact that Amato was the president and Imata was the leader of the group that was trying to assert their rights on Kwajalein. It did result in a major increase in benefits that the people of Ibai and the landowners and the leadership received. But without going into a long story of the details, because I think there's people that are better suited to explain those details, if you look at the situation today, Kwajalein is as nearly a country club, and Ibai as a ghetto. There's just no way you can say that the right thing was being done. Whose fault it is? Marshallese contributed to the fault, the U.S. contributed to the fault, the people of Ibai, the national government, whoever contributed to the fault, no reasonable person can say that the situation on Ibai was reasonable for people to have to live. And that's the situation today. It's unreasonable for so much development to be there across the lagoon and for so little development to be there at Ibai. There was still some control by the military over Ibai that influenced and resulted in a lack of ability to develop. I remember when we brainstormed I was involved in brainstorming the causeway, and we wanted to put the brainstorming was that the local airline would be able to have a runway. The road to Gujigu could be a runway, and then we wouldn't need to stop at Quadge and go through what Kwajalein puts Marshallese through in order to be able to travel through the Marshall Islands and go to Ibai. And the Corps of Engineers came through with a program to electrify Gujigu, and they insisted that it was on poles above ground. Well, that negated the possibility of using that causeway as a runway. And now, was that planned? I kind of feel that that was a conscientious plan, because Kwajalein wanted the control of who entered and exited, and to suddenly have Ibai with an airstrip would have been a tremendous loss of control. So I believe that the program with the Corps of Engineers was deliberate. Of course, you know, Kwajalein has done a lot of good. There's a lot of money been put up, and maybe some bootstrap operations could have been done better. Even the distribution of the funds, which the U.S. now finds to be inequitable, where the Iroch gets a third and the Alps get a third and the Regettables get a third. A lot of that program, be it good or bad, was reinforced initially by the U.S. government. My feeling is to the making it more difficult for ongoing negotiations by not keeping it in sort of a democratic equal voting situation. The U.S. again had more control about what development could take place right next to where they did all of this very sophisticated testing. I feel that there's a lot of areas where Marshallese could have bootstrapped and maybe done better on their own. However, there's no getting away from the fact that they were severely limited by mainly the U.S. military for the use of the land that the military made and the restrictions that the military imposed on that resulted in Marshallese having limited abilities to do some of the development projects that could have been done.
That's great.
What else can I say?
Wow.
Yeah, maybe that's, where are we? We're all, maybe we can do another session. Yeah, this is... Yeah, I wish Charlie was in the, and Tony were in the room.
Our this spec- is great.
Yeah.
I mean, this is really, I learned a lot of stuff. I think, the value of this interview is tremendous, because you're coming in with it's a really unique perspective as someone who's started a business here, but also has seen these significant changes and actually had a hand in changes, like Togwar and all that. I mean, that's
yeah.
What we
well, I can't imagine with 3,000 people. Now there's 28,000.
Should have had that. That all of that is just, I think it's great. I thought that was a great interview.
Well, thank you.
Appreciate your. And you were pulling up a lot of names.
Yeah.
All the names you were forgetting, I said, well, this is great, because I didn't remember half the names that you were pulling out. So, yeah. But the value of this is that you're putting in some key figures and key times along with the historical stuff. I thought it was great.
I need to write some of this down and give you some more of it. I particularly left out some stuff that's a little bit controversial. And there's some other anecdotal stories. I mean, it goes on and on and on. You know, when they first... As an American, you know, it pisses me off to see the mistreatment that, you know, okay, hey, in some ways you got to say these guys screwed up in their own. There's a lot of, you know, he might have put money in his pocket and all, you know, but it pisses me off to see how these people have been abused. When I first came, the Air Force was on Quaj and they provided... you know, I didn't tell you about the airplane business we went into. Oh, yeah, I crashed in the airplane out here. You know, I was at sea for 3 days in a raft.
Get out of here.
Yeah, but see, you're not going to be here. I can't give you the next story. Anyway, the military had a water landing aircraft stationed on Quaj, and at the moment's notice, Marshallese has lost a sick case. Someone there's an emergency, bang, they flew to another island, they provided emergency medical services. Until they signed the Kwajalein lease. Then they packed up and left.
Because they thought that was sufficient.
Yeah. Well, they got what they wanted.
Yeah.
You know, the Marshallese are thinking, hey, this is on forever. These guys are great to us. These are our brethren, you know.
Yeah.
They really, this needs to be said. You want to know, don't blame the old-timers that signed those deals. Look at the state of mind they were in when they signed Quaj over. Look at the state of mind they were in. They were taken advantage of terribly. And the average American would never go for this shit.